This is the 13th of July, 1978, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we are having a session with Bartholomew. Good evening, Master.
Good evening. And I'd like to open tonight with my usual love and gratitude to our friends, and to say again how pleased I was to be in their presence again this past weekend. I had the distinct feeling that the woman would be traveling down south again, and perhaps we would not have an opportunity for a session if there are others in the household who might not go along with this type of thing. But in any case, I think it would be a good idea that she be with you, and that is, if you still hold love in your heart for her, that would be a lovely time for all of you. So, my greetings, and I think we have a question pending here.
Yes, I wonder...
I wanted to say that I realize you have other questions on the list that you had planned to ask, but I do feel that the question that I put forward in our private tape is very important, and I would like to, if you don't mind, to put it in front of the questions that I know that you and our friends had spoken of this past weekend.
Yes, we're very happy to start with this one. It's very important and something that we almost ponder at great length. And the question has to do with meditation, types of recommendations that you would make, warnings about possible pitfalls, and so forth.
Well, basically, I think there are many, many, many pitfalls to the meditator. And, of course, we will discuss them at varying times as they come up. But right now, I would like to say that the major pitfall that I observe on the earth plane in beginning meditators, that is, meditators who have not yet reached the very deep state of non-body identification that some meditators do reach. I'm speaking of, therefore, the so-called neophytes. Even a person who has been meditating for 8 years could still be a neophyte in my terms, in that they have not yet reached a deep level of peace and expansion in their meditative state. Now, if you fall into this category, if you have not yet reached a deep state of peace and expansion, then I would have a few words of advice to you if you're interested in any advice.
Oh, yes.
The main pitfall that I observe is one of allowing the ego to be the meditator rather than the inner source being the meditator. Now, by this I simply mean that there is anything that you do before you are free of the earth plane involves, to some extent, the ego. Do you see?
Yes.
If you're not free of the ego, and if you're not in deep sleep, then you are in some way involved with the ego. So the question then always arises, how to make maximum use of the inner self, the divine force, and to make minimum use of the ego until such time as the ego is as an ash and can be blown to the sky, you see. So, how to do this? Well, the main thing is to be very alert in watching what your ego is doing. For example, many people on the earth plane meditate for 20 minutes, let us say. And in that 20 minutes, they do nothing except think thoughts, come back to center, think thoughts, come back to center, think thoughts. This is a pattern. And when they're done, they get up and they think, well, what a good boy am I? Or what a good girl am I? I mean, they feel that they have done their duty. It is a ritual that they have performed. Their ego then is in a great expanded state, you see. Now, this kind of meditation is hardly of any value at all. Indeed, if it's repeated over and over for a period of years, it is a detriment. And it would be almost better for the person to cease meditating entirely, because then their ego would not have the pretense of being on a spiritual quest, you see. It would be utterly clear that there was nothing happening, and, yeah. and there would be a certain amount of remorse and anxiety about that. Because everyone knows, everyone who will be listening to this tape probably knows that there are deep states that you can achieve if you are willing to try for them. So that is, the main pitfall. Now, you say to me, all right, but I'm trying. Why aren't things going better? Well, now this, of course, is a very difficult thing for me to answer, because for each person, each person has a different situation. So what I would like to do is, since I am not available and will not be available to all these people who will be hearing this tape, I would like to give a general guideline, a way that they themselves can find out about their own situation, which I think will be a much more helpful tool in the long run. Now, first of all, I think the main thrust is to please take your spiritual path seriously, in the sense that you sit down with yourself and you decide the number of so-called methods that you are going to employ, and then follow only those. Do not try and do 100 different things. You mm-hmm. see, we see this happening all the time. They decide they're going to change their diet radically. They're going to change their breathing radically. They're going to do hatha yoga. They're going to do 2 hours of meditation a day. They're going to do mantra all day long. They're going to watch their thoughts. They're going to practice awareness. You see, and the situation is hopeless mm-hmm. because they're doing too many things, and they're not doing any of them actually. So the first suggestion is, since most of you will have a vague outline, a vague understanding of the various tools that are useful on the path, such as the ones I've just mentioned, sit down with such a list, make up your own list, add on to what I have suggested, brought out. And prayer is another one, that should be very much be on that list, I think. Now, make up a list such as I've given, and adding your own to it, and give serious thought to, now, which of these really do I respond to today? Realizing that at the end of the path, most likely you will be doing most of them, you see.
Yes.
You will be slowly doing most of these things. I mean, some may never do mantra, they may practice awareness instead, so on. I mean, I'm not saying absolutely all of them. I'm simply saying that most of these things are a natural movement of the path. So, I would say, please make up such a list, decide which ones are absolutely compelling to you, and take three at the beginning. Three, any three, and focus on these, and do these well, and do them a year, 2 years if necessary, until they're so automatic that you are really able to say that you have become one with that.
I see.
You see, whatever it is, it is more helpful to do it this way than it is to try and heap yourself up. Because you see, if you're paying very close attention, let us say you pick three, diet, mantra, and meditation. Those are the three, by the way, I would suggest for you and your wife, should you care to do it. Those seem to be, does this seem
yes.
natural to you?
Yes.
Seems to be the natural three. Now, of course, when you do mantra, you're doing moment-by-moment awareness, because you cannot do mantra in the method that I have suggested, that of the space,
mm-hmm.
of the without practicing moment-to-moment, as you have no doubt already observed. But as you limit yourself, then you will be able to assess very clearly, well, how well am I doing? How well has my diet changed? You know, has it changed, or have I been fooling myself? Has my ego gotten a hold of this and is just making ego noises, you see? Am I really meditating, or is it simply that I'm making my ego feel good because I get up in the morning and sit in a cross-legged position and burn incense, you mm-hmm. see? Now, in the meditation itself, once this simplification has come, if one of them is meditation that anyone selects to do, the question still arises how to settle your mind. And I still feel, as I am sure I've said on other tapes, but I will say again, I believe that the best way to start out a meditation is through mantra. For those of you that do not do mantra, I suggest breathing, watching your breathing. Something, now when you do mantra in this sense, I mean very slow mantra. I mean slowly, so that the feeling of that tone is in you, you see. It's a feeling of the tone that you're trying to become one with, you see.
Right.
And the slower you go, the more down into your being it will go, and the more able you will be to pick up the nuance of a feeling, a vibration, which will then move into your meditation. Now, if you are one of those who doesn't do this, who would prefer to do the breathing, the same thing is there. The breathing should not be controlled in any way, but absolute attention should be placed on the feeling of the breathing in and out, not on counting. I know many people do approve of that. That's fine. I don't particularly, but there are many ways. In my feeling on this is not that the counting is helpful, but rather the watching of the in and out, the watching of the in and out, and then allowing that breathing in and out to move you into the dropping that. You see, the whole aim is to drop these devices at the beginning, and then just to place yourself in the stillness. Now, those of you who say to me, or to someone, but I cannot stop my thoughts. I have this mind. My mind is running all the time. I cannot stop it. Then I think there's something that we must go into, which I imagine has been on your mind, sir, which is then what are we speaking of mind?
Yes.
What is this that we're discussing? Well, first of all, if you still are unable to stop your thought patterns to any degree, it is because you don't want to. And the reason you don't want to is whatever you believe in, whatever you feel is the most important thing, whatever gives you the greatest happiness and joy is the thing that you will stay with. You see?
Yes.
Most people get a great deal of joy out of any kind of thinking. I don't care if it's negative, desperate, despondent, suicidal. There is a high, in your terms, that goes with that kind of thinking. They enjoy thinking. The whole process of thought is exciting in some sense to many people. So if your thoughts are going to the world, to events, to past events, to emotional encounters, to future encounters, to any of these things, be aware that it's because you still have not broken the great illusion that that is what is making you happy. You still believe, down in your heart, that being a separate ego with a separate mind that creates its own thoughts and moves through those thoughts is what is making you happy. And you will continue to not be able to meditate deeply until you begin to lose hold of that particular concept of happiness. Where your happiness lies, there will your thoughts be. Be assured this is the truth. If your thoughts really believe that you would be happiest being upheld by the peace and joy of God, then that is what you would really be immersing yourself in. But you see, people don't believe it. They're still caught in that idea that their daily ritual, their daily life, has for them the joy that they want.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this kind of person, you understand, has a good life, things have come to equilibrium, they feel content. And there's nothing I can say. To that person, I say, God bless you. I'm very pleased that you've come to a state of equilibrium. In a next lifetime, it may not be so for you. And then we will see. We'll work with it then. Because many people have been able to so protect themselves against the pain that exists in the world that they simply do not feel it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They have put a protective coating around them. You know, many people say, well, I like my life. My life is just fine. And, you know, I really am enjoying this. And you look around and their life is relatively in harmony. At that moment, things are in a state of peace. There's no great trauma happening. But the trouble here, sir, is this. To the person who says that, they are looking at their own life. And it is true that there are many individual lives that are going very well, you see. But if you could only see, if that person could only see that they are a part of the whole humanity, and if they could then project outside of their own little world and say, yes, but what about the people two doors down?
Mm-hmm.
What about these people I hear about on the radio? What about the horrible things that I know are happening to other people? You see, the world is so united now that you know of all these deep sorrows.
This is what happened to the Buddha.
That's right. That's right. But what about all those people, you see? Could you have some more? So, while each individual life observed may seem totally in balance and in harmony, and therefore there is no need for a deep thrust of awareness, you see, of struggling to try to reach the light. If you can't do it for yourself, you see, I've said this over and over again, if you can't do it for yourself, please do it for the world. Please do it for someone else. Find someone in the world who you know is aching, who is in sorrow, who is despondent, who cannot see the light of day, who lives and walks and has their being in the darknesses of an emotional or a physical hell, and do it for them. Realize that although you may be one of those fortunate at this moment in your incarnation, that everything is in harmony, be aware that its opposite will follow at some further time, until such time as you can break yourself out of this situation of illusion. If you have not seen the illusion, then I say, please do not allow your own complacency, your own mellowed life, to so influence you that you seek, that you cease seeking the highest. Because you see, each person on this globe that is seeking the highest helps everyone. Every ounce of, you know, every increment of movement that any one of you makes helps the whole globe. And this is the way in which we would ask you to see it. Mm-hmm. If your life is, in fact, that person actually has the hardest job. You know, the person who isn't really sensitive to other people's sorrow because they feel that their own life is in such harmony that they can't really, they don't want the sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You see, they don't want to open themselves up to that pain. And this is understood. You know, nobody wants to feel this, but we are all one. And what happens to your brother happens to you. Know this to be truth. When your brother is in pain, you're in pain too. You may not know it. You may have constructed a wall that says, I'm fine, I'm happy, my life is in harmony. But be aware that there is out there somewhere an aching brother who so needs help. And the only way, well, not the only way, but the highest way to expedite this is to begin with all due seriousness to begin your own walk, to keep your walk going, to keep the struggle in the foremost of your heart, and to keep working, if not for yourself, dear ones, please, for someone else. I really ask you, there are so many of your brothers. Oh, if you could but remember and understand and feel once again the days of your own darkness, you will realize that those days of darkness exist as desperate realities for so many people. And if you cannot find within your heart the power to work for yourself, then please do it for someone else.
Would you care to comment a little further on the function of despair?
Well, despair is saved for those people who cannot respond in any other way. You know, despair has a purpose, and it is usually a matter of being in such a darkness that you have a choice to make. Either you envision insanity, which some pick as an out, and we're not speaking of those really, but the person who doesn't choose that has two choices. If the despair is very deep, they will either choose a suicidal situation,
mm-hmm.
or they will make a resolve on some level to get out of it, to begin the climb out. And on the climbing out, of course, most of the time, they go through a lot of other ways first, psychological and so on, only to find that part of their despair has lessened, but nothing has really removed from them. They're still carrying darkness. And that's when finally somehow they begin to move into the light and will move on from there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the basis of it. It's a kind of a built-in mechanism of the human. When he gets so far off the track, there are warning signals, you see. When you're really going off the track, the warning signals come, and despair is one of them. Hopelessness, despair, gloom, imbalance of the emotional nature, lots of crying outbursts, or anger, outbursts of great anger, this kind of thing, tells you you're off the track, and it is a warning signal. But I think we should go back to meditation, because I feel I haven't quite finished that.
Certainly.
Is that your feeling?
Yes.
All right, so I say once again, let's go back to the situation where you're seated there, and you've done either your breathing or the mantram, or both. You see, you can do mantram for a while and then go into watching the breathing. Whatever works for you is what you should use. Now, when you have placed your consciousness in your heart area, or to the right of your heart area, whichever is the way you want to express that, then the best way to remove your attention from your wandering thoughts is to do as I have suggested before, which is to fasten your attention on what isn't there. You see, on the emptiness within, on that inner space, to fasten your attention on that. Now, I want to say something that I should have said before about this. When you are watching both in and out, which are the same, but when you have your awareness placed on that, on space, within and without, it must be a dynamic watching. You see? It cannot be a lethargic observation. You have to be fully participating in this. Do you understand what I mean?
I think so.
There has to be a participation in that process. You have to be in that process. I realized that I might have not made this clear enough, and so I'm glad for this opportunity. What you must do is to become dynamic in your watching. Dynamic. That means your whole being, your whole body structure is mobilized, in a sense, in this. And this is where the real power comes, sir. This is where the real movement in meditation comes. It's when you are able to build, to use the vibrational aura. You're using your whole aura, you see, and to really use this in a dynamic movement, it will break down the barriers for you. You see, sitting in meditation, just very mellow is a word I hear much used, in a very quiet and mellow state, is not really what I'm advocating. Mm-hmm. Now, for those of you who cannot find harmony with this, that's fine, but I would just like to say this is not the highest. Is there? Should we stop for a minute?
No, please proceed.
This is not the highest state of meditation. What is the highest state is to, and you will only understand me by doing. You see, listen to these words, those of you who are interested. Listen to them 2 and 3 and 4 times until perhaps the vibrational frequency of my voice will begin to impress upon you what I mean. And what I mean is, you must learn to get your power together. You know, your language is reflecting so much of the deep truth these days that we are amazed. It's something to behold. And one of them is, in your terminology, you say you must get it together.
Mm-hmm.
You must get your scene together, or something of this kind, or your act together, or whatever. All right, now, these are very shallow statements in a sense. They reflect a very deep truth, because that's precisely what you must do. You must get yourself together. You must take all of this energy that is constantly moving around your physical vehicle and focus it inside yourself, what you would call inside yourself. Bring it in. Hold it in there. Be so attuned to your within that, you see, as your focus goes within with a dynamic movement, with a dynamic feeling, it will call on the area energy around it to come to it to help support this process, you see. It will do it on its own accord. You cannot will the energy to move there, mm-hmm. you see. This is its own natural law. Energy goes where it's focused. That's the law. If your energy is focused on another human being, your energy is there. Mm-hmm. And this is why we say to you that the greatest help you can give another person who you really care about, or if you ever want to break down a negative relationship and turn it into a positive one, is to focus every amount of positive thought and love energy on that person. And you will begin to break down the negative thoughts if they are there. And in the case of a love relationship, you will aid them. You see, someone who is sick, someone who is emotionally in difficulty, whatever. That is the process. Because wherever your thought goes, wherever your energy goes, your thinking and your energy move together, and that's where your energy will be. And it will have the nuance of your thought. Your energy carries the nuance of your thought. So if you are thinking a very terrifying thought about someone, be aware that they're receiving it. I mean, they're not aware, oh, I see, this person is thinking this terrible thought about me. No, but they're receiving it. We're all receiving stations, you know. And certainly in the physical world you are, although you don't observe it. On the higher planes you see it easily. You see light moving and forms moving this way, and it's easily perceived. Down here it's harder because of the illusion of the separate bodies, the illusion of bodies. So again, back to this. Let us just say and end this here, that this particular subject, that the movement is to be dynamic in your meditation. What is the expression on your earth plane? A cat watching at the hole of a mouse. Something mm-hmm. of this nature. This is the kind of thing I'm asking for. And I'm asking for it a lot during the day. I'm not saying that it's something you just do in the morning and night and then forget about it. During the day, and as many moments as you can, get your energy together again in this spatial meditation that we've discussed, you see. Get it in there. When you do a mantra, make sure there's a dynamic power movement going there. Mm-hmm. Make use of that feeling. Mm-hmm. All right?
Very good. Thank you.
If there's any questions, I'd be very pleased to answer them.
Well, one occurs to me. I've noticed recently, and it may be that I'm not using the technique properly, but I get the feeling occasionally at work when I do think about the inner space that I'm getting, to use a colloquial expression, spaced out.
Yes, you will. I told you wouldn't know yourself in November.
And I'm grateful for that.
And you're approaching November. No, yes, that's part of it. And that's one of the reasons why you won't be at the prison. Because, you see, spaced out at the prison won't work.
I know.
There's too much alertness necessary for various unfortunate reasons out there. And this is why eventually you'll be moved out of that position. By your own choice. I mean, you certainly won't be fired, or I hope, don't mean to make any such reference. But it's that kind of thing. Yes, and of course the woman is having equally the same difficulty at work. And she's finding that she's not able to do. And I think this is a good time to talk about this. I'm sure if it's true for the two of you, it's true for anyone who is having to hold down a job. You know, comes the question, and a very valid question, which is, how do you do these dynamic exercises at their maximum and still be able to retain the necessary awareness to perform a job well? Well, unfortunately, in the beginning stages, it is almost impossible to do. I'm sorry, but it is that way. In the later stages, you will be so integrated into that you will be able to do most anything. You know, I mean anything. Mm-hmm. And will not have this trouble. So I can only say, please be patient with yourself and be patient with the process. Take your knocks, so to speak. If you make an error, just apologize. Just say, I'm terribly sorry, I'll try to do better. Realizing that it isn't terribly important at all to do a perfect job. This is something we hear a lot from your earth plane. A lot of emphasis is placed on doing your mundane jobs perfectly. And if that is your form of spiritual discipline, if you are practicing that as your spiritual discipline, then of course it's important, not because the work you're doing is important, but because that's your discipline, and that's what it's called for. But for many of you who are doing other things, we do not see that it is such a terrible sin to not always be able to be 100% correct, to be 100% in the right movement of your job. You see, we don't see it that way, because the jobs that most of you do are not important at all.
That's the feeling I get. Well, the job, it's not very important.
No, no job is important. The reason a job is important is it serves as a vehicle for you to learn.
Mm-hmm.
It is a vehicle for you to learn that you are in a state of limitation.
Yeah.
And each job teaches that, no matter what it is. This is why it doesn't matter if you're on an assembly line or president.
Mm-hmm.
The same lesson has to be learned from everyone, which is that you are limited. And a job shows us up faster than anything.
Yes.
And this is why some of the greatest movement is made on the path for people who are working.
Uh-huh.
And many people who are so-called on the spiritual path and withdraw from jobs waste many years. And the reason is they select very carefully their environment. They select who they see and what they do. And they try, of course, to eliminate all outer stress and strain. Now, this is one great help of most ashrams. Ashrams do not eliminate stress and strain.
How true.
Ashrams can be a great boiling pot for energies, negative and so forth. And they can be very well used, you see. Now, the farce, of course, is the people in the ashram feel that they have withdrawn and they find themselves surrounded by many situations that would be similar on the outside world. So they haven't really changed too much.
Mm-hmm.
But the person that we're really speaking to is the one who is in an isolated situation in a home, living at home alone, who has the whole day to themselves, and who doesn't make use of it. In fact, if they watch carefully, they'll find that it's very difficult to alone sustain the kind of pace of awareness that we need, especially when there's nothing there pushing against you, you see.
Mm-hmm.
It just gives you too much space in the early days. Now, of course, this is an optimum situation in the later years, after you really have become one with your program, once you've really become one with the way that you have selected to move, then it is extremely helpful not to have to work, at least not to work all the time. And it is this aim to which we're working for you and your wife.
Yes, I felt that at this juncture, the job situation provides a very important structure to the life, and that's not altogether bad.
No,
right?
Actually, it's excellent. It's excellent. Now, it's not necessary for people further along the path. They can spend hours and hours in meditative states and get into very deep and meaningful awarenesses, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But even the great ones like the Maharshi and Ramakrishna and so forth, they all spent much of their time working. They didn't just sit around and either they were instructing students or reading or writing or doing. They were always doing something along some line or other. I don't mean they were always, writing and so forth. But their lives were not just sitting in bliss all day and all night. You know, there was work to be done and they got on with it. And this is what is necessary. So I hope I've covered more of these. And again, I say, if you find yourself in a job, and if you find that you are so-called spaced out and not really able to always perform, don't worry about it. Accept that as part of the training. Know that it will end, that the more you do it, the sooner it will end. And don't be concerned if you're not performing perfectly. Do not be concerned, unless that is, of course, your particular thrust on the path. Then, of course, it's a different situation.
Is that final reference to what's been called karma yoga?
Yes, well, there are certain people who practice moment-to-moment awareness. The Vipassana meditation is one of them that does this. There are other names and other traditions that do it, but karma yoga is one of them. That is putting yourself totally in what you're doing. And if that is what you're doing, then that's fine. Then, of course, you must do your best,
mm-hmm.
you see, to do everything precisely. And then if you fail, that's fine too. And if you do well, that's fine too. But the aim is always 100% to
right.
be able to do it well. But that is only one type of, and of course, the person who is drawn to that type of yoga is very upset at people who are less precise.
Right.
And they have to deal with that, you see. That's something for them to deal with. We all have to deal. Be assured, if you have a negative feeling about anyone, it is your problem. I don't care how obvious the other person's so-called error, it is your problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone listening to this tape makes errors. There's no one listening to this tape that does not make errors all the time. If not daily, perhaps even hourly sometimes. That is the nature of egos. They make mistakes. They make wrong actions. They say wrong things. They hope for things that do not materialize. And they blame others. And they always blame someone else. They never are at fault. In fact, if they are at fault, they're just partially at fault. And in their deep heart of hearts, they're saying, well, it was really the other person's problem. Mm-hmm. It was really their fault, you see. But it isn't so. Because each time life presents you with an event, you have a choice to make. The choice is, how are you going to respond? You can respond two ways. In total, utter forgiveness and love, realizing that they share the same burden you do. They're an ego and you're an ego. They're making the mistake now. 10 minutes from now, you'll be making yours. You see, realize your oneness with them, even in the ego. You see,
yes.
There is a oneness even in the blundering of the ego. And if you can use this to realize and to let go of any hostilities, any feelings of superiority, because you see, every time it's superiority.
Mm-hmm.
If your ego is pricked, it is because you feel your superiority has been threatened. In some way, your superior position of being number one is being threatened. And look carefully at this. In some way, go through the whole process. If you don't believe me, take an event and get and work it through as best you can, and you will see that at the basis of it, with very few exceptions, I cannot really think of many exceptions in the entire earth plane, do not come to the fact that number one, which is yourself, is threatened in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Either for physical harm or emotional harm or just plain old ego
prestige.
Somewhere your view of yourself as being all wise, all wonderful, omniscient, omnipresent,
mm-hmm.
is being threatened.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see, the ego would love to see itself in those terms. And it isn't. And you know it isn't, because you look at other people and you know you're the same as they are. If you're being honest, you look at another ego and every mistake they make, you say, ah, here we go again.
Mm-hmm.
You and me too, brother. And you mean it. You say, it's your turn. Mine will be next minute. I forgive you. And please forgive me when it's my turn. You see? It's this kind of constant forgivingness in your own being.
Yes.
That honestly drops the burden, the terrible burden of this kind of thing. You know, it hurts inside your being. It hurts your being to carry this kind of resentment against other people. And if there's anyone listening to this tape that says, I have no such resentments, I would say to them, I'm sorry, I feel you're living in a dishonest perception of yourself. Because as long as you maintain your view of yourself as an ego, you will believe what I have just said. The ego functions best thinking itself to be omniscient and omnipresent and everlasting. It will never die. That is its illusion. And the sadness and the terror of the ego is knowing that it will die. It does not have within it the sustained power of the divine force. And it knows it, but it doesn't want to face it. You see, this is the whole trauma of the ego and why it is so fearful and why it is so terrified of being destroyed. Because it knows it can be destroyed. It knows it has failed in its major job. The one thing the ego wanted to do was to be a copy of God in its own terms. Personal, yet godlike, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Individual, yet with God's attributes. And it doesn't have them.
Mm-hmm.
Everything the ego makes dies. Nothing that God makes dies. And it is an unfair... they're
it's
not
a stack
comparable.
Deck.
They're not comparable, but the ego will not face... Most egos go through eons of incarnations refusing to face this one thing, that it has not been able to pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
That the game it set out to do, the game it set up to play, has failed. And it takes lifetimes to face this. But again, we go back to the original theme. I do not care how much another party seems to have wronged you. If you have responded in a negative state, you know it is your problem. Because it means that in 10 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 month, whatever, you will be doing the same. In some form or other, if not instantly, you will eventually be in their position. Mm-hmm. Because egos are one. Egos are one. Everything is one. There is only one. Egos are one. They see themselves as separate, and that's where they get such joy, being separate. When they finally see that they are one, that everything you give to your brother, you give to yourself, when you see that, you will start giving your brother great love and great understanding and great forgiveness and great harmony. Do you see? Once you begin to perceive this, you will take seriously what you give your brother, because you realize that what you give to him, you give to yourself. You are the same. It is one. It isn't that you're like each other. You see, humans think in terms of, well, he's like me. Mm-hmm. You see, that's not what I'm speaking of.
He is you.
He is you. There is no not you. He is you. And you don't know that because your perception lies to you. He is you. Whatever you give to your brother, be assured you are giving it to yourself, and you will receive it. And you will receive it directly. Because what you give to him, you see, and reflects back to you, and you take it. You see? It's all a movement. It's all a movement of going out and coming in, going out and coming in. What you give to him, you give to him something. Let us say you give anger. All right? I don't care how clever you are at disguising it. You give anger in some underhanded way, perhaps, some cunning, aloof way of pretending to be not angry. But, you know, it's there. And if the anger's there, it moves. All right? And it goes to the other person. They feel it. They respond to it. And what happens? They respond back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so who's got it? All right? You've both got it. And the reason that he has it is because he wasn't able, when it came at him, he wasn't able to say, oh, I don't care. I forgive you. I love you. I don't care. So you've made a mistake. So I'll make mine tomorrow. I love you. Let's forget about it. You see? If he did that, the ball, so-called, would drop dead.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And you would, instead of perceiving your own anger, you would perceive love and acceptance, and you would say, oh, I want that. And that would move to you. You see? This is why every time you find yourself in a negative situation with anyone, from the mildest little agitation, which is usually much deeper than you would allow,
mm-hmm.
You see, egos react, but they hide it.
Hmm.
They hide it under many pretenses. And the holier you think you are, the less you think you react.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the unfortunate laws. There's some people that think, I never have emotional problems, I am just above it all. Well, not true. If you're thinking that kind of thought, the fact is that you've probably pushed a lot of things out of your consciousness so that you wouldn't have to see yourself as an angry person. A lot of people on the earth, everyone on the earth plane has some form of anger. Unless they have transmuted it and then have seen everyone as one, you see. Up until that time, they have anger because they have fear. Fear and anger go together. Separation, fear, and anger go together. Guilt and judgment. Those five sit on the same seat. So if you have one, you have them all. They all go at the same time. And how they go is when you perceive that you and your brother are one, are absolutely one,
mm-hmm.
and that what you give him is what you give to yourself. When you perceive this, you begin to loosen up. You see, you really begin to be free. You begin to be very careful about what thoughts you send out, not for any phony, holy reason, but because you have now become aware of the dynamic process of oneness, that your minds are together, your minds are connected.
Mm-hmm.
And what your mind thinks, their mind picks up. And once you really understand this, that there is no way you can fool them, you know, that you really can't fool them.
That's right.
Then you don't seek to fool them anymore. You say, oh, let's share. And then you begin to want to share the highest in you, because you find that you do care. You find you do care. You do want to be a caring, loving, uplifting person rather than a negative and debilitating person. And so you consciously make this choice over and over again. Every moment of the day that some negative thought comes in, be aware it's not somebody else. Please be aware it is you. And you maintain this process. Let's say you have a negative thought about somebody hundreds of miles away. Without them being conscious of it, it reaches them because you hold them in image. Thoughts have power. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it is so wonderful that thoughts have power is that's how you're going to get yourself out of this box you've created. But we'll talk about that another time. Please put that down somewhere.
Okay.
Because I think that would be an important thing to discuss. But let us take this on from here. So you think about someone hundreds of miles, thousands of miles away. Someone who's dead. Well, actually, the dead are closer than thousands of miles away. So let's put it thousands of miles away. And it's a negative thought, just a negative thought that you pass through your mind. And it goes through your mind and out, and you think nothing of it.
Right.
But the person to whom you were thinking, that energy moves to their aura, wherever they are, and feeds into that aura. And that's why hate can kill. Because it gets in there and begins to lower their resistance. Now, a very high person, thoughts of evil have very little effect on them. And you can never kill another person, you know, by your thoughts. They have to have something within them that hooks up with it, that responds to it.
But you debilitate them?
You can help the process. Let's put it this way. You see, you're all one. And that's why we go back to our basic theme. You are all one. You are not illusory. The illusion is that you're separate. You're one. And what one person thinks about another person is transmuted to them, transmitted to them. It goes directly to them. And it affects them. If it's an uplifting, loving, I love you, I forgive you, I don't care what you've done, we're in this together, you are my brother, and I walk in joy with you. If it's that kind of a thought, you've uplifted them. You've helped them. You've done a real service. If, on the other hand, your thought is, oh boy, well, let's not go into them. There's so many negative thoughts that could come in. Then to the degree of which the venom is forceful is the degree to which it permeates their aura and does its job. So both works. You see, you can't only have goodness. You know, you are protected to a certain extent. You know, everyone has a certain amount of protection. So it isn't fair to say that one person could kill another with thought. What is possible is to bombard them so much with negativity, the negative thought, that it surrounds them, and it just takes a great deal more energy on their part to stay in a positive state. Mm-hmm. And so these are important rules and laws, and the reason that people say think positively is not for yourself, except indirectly. It's for others. The more positive you can think, the more you will uplift the whole world, and of course that in turn helps you. I mean, make no mistake, it ends up being a help to you. And if you think good thoughts about other people, generally, unless they're really in a very, very dark state, they will start thinking good thoughts about you. So you see, you end up helping yourself. What you give to them, you get back. It's the rule. You know it all. Most people know this, that listen to this tape.
Yes, I was interested to hear you say that unless they're in a very dark state, because I think I've observed on occasion where I do have good thoughts for another person. And I may say something in jest, and they'll really take it wrong and think I'm being extremely negative and trying to humiliate them, and I'm not at all. I mean, I have good feelings for the person, and it really surprises me that they could misread it so.
Well, people in a negative state misread most things. You know, they misread looks, they misread speech. They can misread most anything that comes their way. And that's why it's so interesting on the earth plane that what one person is thinking, the other person if they really want to, if they can look past the words, they could get the feeling. But a lot of people get trapped in the words and won't allow themselves to open up. You see, it's a matter of opening up. If as anything comes to you, if you open up to it and allow it to be experienced in you, then you'll understand it. You know, you will really begin to understand it. All right, I think I'm ready to make this question.
Okay, well, I was intrigued by one comment of yours that all egos are one. I don't think I understand that. If the ego in some sense is unreal, how are all egos one?
Well, all right. Now, you see, this is where our terminology becomes so difficult. What we have to say here is that if you could see an ego, you would realize that there are millions and millions of particles of light moving through a space, so-called space here, that you would call an ego. This body occupies, in your terms, it occupies a piece of space, correct? Mm-hmm. Now, it seems very solid and all this, we've talked about this before, but if you could see it, you would see that it is constantly changing. For example, as you and your wife sit here in this room together, part of her whole energy field is moving into yours, and yours is moving into hers. The painting is moving into yours. That's why the painting's important.
Mm-hmm.
The painting moves into yours. The sky, when the sun comes in, its particles move into yours. There is no separation. You don't end at your skin.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say that all the egos are one, what we're simply saying is that it's just a constant flowing. You see, there's a flowing always going on between all of God's creation is in flow. It's all flowing. It's all moving energy. It flows. It has a rhythm and it flows. And on this earth plane, it's denser, you see. It seems to be very dense. Your perception perceives it as very dense, and that's how you get the feeling of bodies. Because your thoughts have built these bodies in order to carry out this illusion of separate entities that you're so determined to play out.
Mm-hmm.
But in actuality, the way that egos are one are simply, they are not at all static. They're constantly moving. Thoughts are moving. There's nothing within you that is always staying the same. And this is why organs can rebuild themselves. This is why illnesses can leave you. If everything stayed the same, you would never... That makes no sense. Now, the human being's mind knows this. They know that they're always changing. They get sick, they get well. That's a change, is it not?
Yes.
All right? They get older. That's a change. They put on weight. That's a change. They lose weight. That's a change.
Mm-hmm.
There are countless things that they do that are changes. But they don't perceive that, as we've said before. They keep their eye on the static, on the things that they think are static. But in fact, everything is constantly moving out and being shared. You know, you and your wife are constantly sharing parts of yourself with each other. All the time. All the time. This is why you can be in the presence of someone and feel funny. You can feel ill at ease.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that part of them is moving into you. It isn't that everyone is so attuned psychically. It's simply that actually something's moving into you. Part of their so-called ego, so-called whatever you want to call it, this energy field is moving, and it moves to you. Now, the thing is that most of the things that we talked about before, most of those things that do not have hookups in your power system will just leave you. They'll just go on, you see. If you're in the presence of someone very negative, it is true that for the moment you might feel uneasy. But why not? You're part of human nature. You can do that. That's not asking too much as part of the great brotherhood, is it?
No.
To just allow yourself to feel a little uneasy. So what? So what? This is a brother who's doing his best, who's trying, who's part of you, you know. And it moves past you. That negative energy does not stick. It doesn't have any polarity to you, if I could use it that way, all right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have any It doesn't have any home. It doesn't have anything that hooks up with it. So something that does hook up with you stays with you. And this is why people who are married usually have pretty much the same rate of vibration. It isn't always that case, but oftentimes it is the case, because they just do better. It just works better if, well, let's put it this way. The better marriages are people who usually have about the same type of energy that they're pulling in. It makes their life more harmonious. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. There isn't too much going on. Now, one reason why having children around is hard is that they have different energies oftentimes from their parents, mostly because they're younger. They're experiencing different things. They're in amongst many, many people in schools and so forth. And they bring home a lot of that, and it dissipates eventually. So it's just a matter of all these energies moving around in one structure mm-hmm. that make it very difficult oftentimes. And the more in the structure, the harder it is. That's one reason why college life is so difficult. Because they're all crammed together in these dormitories where they live so very close. And a lot of this interchange goes on that they don't know about. And that's one reason why college is has such an impact on a young person.
Uh-huh.
That day and night they're bombarded, night too. You know, in the sleep state they're bombarded. But that's all right. It's all part of the one. It's all right.
Now that we're talking about egos and bodies and reality, there's a question that's left over from our last taping. It's been commented that when human consciousness came to the planet, it found a humanoid type of body that it could work with for its own purposes, to develop it to the point that it would be a suitable vehicle for human consciousness. And then this raises the question of the sense in which we're talking, the different senses in which you use the word reality. I think that you do use the word in different ways for different contexts and purposes. If human consciousness found the body there and decided to work with it, then in some sense, the body was not its illusion, the human mind's illusion, it was there.
That's right.
So what are the
all right.
different ways to understand this notion of reality when we're talking about it's real or it's illusory?
All right. I think that's a very good question. All right, first of all, realize that it is not only the earth plane upon which these protuberances decided to enter into an exchange with. It is true that on the planet you call Earth, they chose to take over part animal bodies and work with that vehicle. At the same time, throughout many parts of the universe, other protuberances who were part of this movement have entered other planes of existence that were not bodies. This is why you have a universe that's inhabited by various types of beings, you see. Your fantasies about other planets and their peoples, their life forms, well, they're valid. There are, of course, other life forms on other planets, no question about that. So do you see what I'm saying? First of all, in that sense, the planet is real. This planet is not an illusion. This mm-hmm. planet is not going to evaporate in that sense, you see. All right?
When any given person becomes enlightened, the planet doesn't disappear.
The planet remains, no. Now, the sense in which we keep saying the real and the unreal is simply to try to point out to you that the only things that we consider real are the things that are upheld, as we've talked about, that are upheld by the divine power. Now, after a being is enlightened, everything he perceives is upheld by the divine power. He sees only the divine moving. And what he sees is what you see, only he doesn't see it that way at all. But he sees the same thing. He knows it's a tree. He knows it's a stone. He knows it's another body. He knows it's a cow. I mean, he knows all that. That is there, you see. Mm-hmm. That is one level of reality. There are many levels of reality, you see. So that is one level. But the way that he experiences and sees that cow is totally different from the way you do. Mm-hmm. And it is yours. Most of the humans perceive erroneously. They perceive the separateness. They do not perceive the essence. They perceive the exterior. They do not perceive the movement. How can I best express this? An enlightened person will sit in a forest, and the trees will all be there. All right? He will go into a meditative state. Or maybe he doesn't even have to go into a meditative state, some of them, but most of them still have to go into a meditative state, a state of quietness, all right, as in looking at this forest. The forest will take on the life that pulsates through it, and he will be able to see that. I cannot speak clearer than this because it's something you have to understand. You look at a tree and you see a trunk and maggots and leaves and worms and what all right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't see that. He's looking at a tree. You would draw it, it would have the same form that his has, the same shape, but he doesn't see it that way. What he sees is the incredible movement, the incredible that tree, and he perceives the incredible, moving, dynamic life force that is embodied in that structure. Do you see? Mm-hmm. He looks at space and sees it as alive. He looks at rocks and sees that they are divinely alive. There is a life there. Everything is alive. Nothing is dead. And he perceives that. And that is what gives him this incredible joy, because he knows there is no death. He knows there is no destruction. He knows that all is in a continuing change. But it's a change of dynamic creation, you see. It's a creation that's happening there. And he sees this self. He sees this creative, ongoing movement of the divine life. And that's what he sees. It's the life divine. That's what he perceives. He perceives it in himself and feels that incredible oneness. He sees the similarity, because he feels, you see, the oneness. He sees the movement in himself, the same life force is filling that tree. I mean, he sees it. Mm-hmm. And that's how all is one. The divisions are there, you see. There are two bodies. But he sees the essence of that, the movement between, and the similarity of all life. It's all life. It's all the same substance. Only it takes now the form of a tree, now the form of a man, now the form of a rock, now the form of a bird, you see? But it's all the same substance, and that's what he perceives. Have I made this any clearer?
Yes, but it suggests to me one comment, which is that the Western world, which I guess from the time of Aristotle and certainly down from the time of Descartes into the modern scientific age, has preferred to see the world as mechanistic and dead, and we pride ourselves in our great technology and the great wisdom of Western culture, whereas on the other hand, what we would like to call primitive cultures, of which there have been many more than there has been Western technological culture, numerically, almost all of them, in fact, probably every single so-called primitive culture has just the opposite view, that there is this dynamic life force in things. Bushman will see part of his soul in the tree, or which becomes special to him, or in a certain animal, and
yes.
So forth.
All right, I see your thrust. All right, but let us speak to that point then. Because then the question could be asked, well, then isn't it better to be a bushman? Isn't it better to be in the outback of Australia?
Right.
All right. Well, the answer is no, and the reason is the fear element. You will notice that in all of these primitive tribes, the motive is usually fear. There is an incredible amount of fear involved in that whole process. They perceive They perceive in an unstructured way. That is true. They do not have the structure in their mind that you do, you know. But there isn't, there's a lot of darkness in that. There's a lot of dark fear. If you will look closely at most of those early tribes that are still existent on the planet, they are not enlightened in the sense that there is not light there, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They're suspicious, they're fearful, they're isolated, they have a tremendous amount of ritual that goes around every act they perform. They make no connection between one act and another at all. They move almost, it's almost on an instinctual animal level, you see. And that is a very different kind of thing. And that is a beginning of the process of awakening. Now, that is not really the kind of thing that I'm talking about. You're talking about a bushman who sees his soul in an animal, and therefore feel some kind of a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true, they do. But at the same time, you must understand that they still see themselves as totally separate in a sense. I mean, it is, there's no oneness in the sense of his vision is open to the light. His vision is open in the sense that he feels, he's a feeling person rather than a thinking person, you
mm-hmm.
see. So he feels the connection. He feels the oneness with this animal.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't understand yet. He doesn't understand yet. And this, as you know, as we've said before and we'll say again, it's you made up the game, and one of the ways that you like to play this game is that you're evolving more and more wisdom, higher and higher consciousness. And somebody has to play the part of the lower one.
Mm-hmm.
And people elect to do that. And that's how they come in, and that's what they play. That's their role. That's their job. And they do it. And they get a certain amount of awareness and experience out of that. They proceed from that to another stage, you see, in that
mm-hmm.
lifetime, perhaps. Do you see my point?
Yes.
That it is an instinctual response to, but no understanding of, the oneness.
Okay.
They do not feel, for example, one with everything. They just feel one with certain isolated things that they feel this pull toward. And mostly they feel fear. They feel a great deal of fear about things that they don't understand because their minds are darkened and they don't understand. They don't understand a lot of things. And this makes them fearful. They seem to be caught, even more than modern man, they seem to be caught in a web where nature absolutely runs their life and destroys them. You see, they're so, primitive cultures are very much dependent on the movement of the seasons. The
yes.
seasonal world is very important to them. Nature and how it expresses for them is very important. But as I say, it's all a plan. They've all decided. It's up to them. They choose to do it. They are learning something from it. And that's all. But there's no way that one should wish to return to that kind of feeling.
Right. No, I don't want to return to that. I was just thinking that maybe we're not
far
advanced beyond them as...
But
we think we are.
Yes, but indeed you are, in a sense, you see. Now, there are certain isolated tribes that have just become beautiful and light-filled. And they don't seem primitive at all,
mm-hmm.
but they're rare.
Would that be true for any American Indian, so-called, before the West was overtaken by the culture of the white man?
Certain isolated ones, very definitely.
I'm thinking in the plains,
mm-hmm.
the Cheyenne. Or
yes,
the...
very definitely.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great deal there. There was a great deal there.
Okay, well, it's just a question I had. And
the reason it failed was they didn't hold to their vision.
Uh-huh. Yes, that's been a book that touched me very much, entitled Black Elk Speaks. Black Elk, I submit, was a very unusual person.
Yes, but there could have been many more, you know. But they didn't hold. They didn't hold to their vision. As a tribe, as a group, there were isolated ones who held to the vision
mm-hmm.
and suffered greatly because they saw what might have been Yeah. But the tribes themselves chose to move away from the vision. If they had held to the vision, things would have been different.
Mm-hmm.
But they allowed themselves to become afraid. They allowed themselves to lose their vision and to get confused and to feel that the land was more important than the vision and to go into a state of hate.
I see.
Because they gave up the vision. When the hate entered, the vision left. You see, high, lofty visions cannot be sustained in an environment of hate.
Right.
And they felt they had very justifiable hates, and it certainly does appear that way. But the whole point was that they didn't hold to their vision.
So to some extent, the very regrettable situation of many people of that lineage today is it could have been otherwise had they chosen otherwise.
Right, but they could return, some of them, but I think it's been too long to return to the power of the vision. It takes a long time to build the powers of those visions, you know. And the Indian tribes, many of them, had built over the centuries a great powerful vision.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't hold to it. They moved into a state of hate, and the vision died.
You know, I hadn't wanted to ask this, but now that we're talking about it, it's been on my mind a great deal recently. I perceive that one of the problems that we have as a culture, American society, is that we don't seem to have this kind of vision that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have and hold to and move forward to touch a vision that's greater than ourselves and our mundane little material interests.
Well, that's, of course, exactly the state of decay. And even many people on the so-called spiritual path, when asked to present their vision, they have none. You know, it's the way visions are built is it takes individuals together, individuals, first of all, forming within their own consciousness a vision. Another word for vision is a goal.
Mm-hmm.
All right, these are synonymous words. And I really would submit to anyone listening to these tapes, please be aware of what your vision is. Everybody has a vision. And most of them have a vision unconsciously, and it is so mundane that if they were to bring it into their consciousness, they would be disgusted with themselves. But everyone has a vision. Everyone believes in something. Everyone has a goal. The problem is we don't take our goals seriously because we don't realize the basic law. So I would like to bring about a statement about a law, and I'm grateful that you bring this up at this time. There is a basic law that mankind operates under but is not aware of totally. I mean, isolated people, of course, but in the main, people are not aware of this. And the basic law is that whatever your goal is, you will move toward it. You will amass your energies and move toward it. That's a law. Now, you say to me, well, how is that practical? That means you see it countless times all around you. A man decides that he wants to make money, and he begins to move toward it. If he holds that thought in his mind long enough, it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you hold as your goal, you will amass your energies consciously and, please believe me, unconsciously, you will mass your energies and move toward it. This is why so many people don't progress on the spiritual path, because consciously they think that this is their goal, but actually they're deceiving themselves. Their goal is something quite different. Maybe it's that they wish to be a guru. Many people on the spiritual path have this problem. They wish to be a teacher. They enjoy the job of teaching. And they don't realize that they have substituted wisdom, the goal of wisdom, for the goal of teaching. Because most teachers don't teach much wisdom in the earth plane today. There are very few really fine teachers on the earth plane. A lot of people are teaching, but there's not a great deal of value being taught, you see. And the reason is that most people in teaching positions, I'm speaking of spiritual teachings now,
yeah,
are teaching from a perception of wanting to see themselves as a wise teacher. That is their goal, you see. Now, that's a very great difference between someone perceiving themselves that way and someone who knows that their goal is to know, is to embody and manifest in whatever mundane way possible to to manifest the truth. Do you see? In one case, the goal is to be a teacher, which has an ego, a tremendous ego attachment to it. On the other hand, the goal is to become one with the truth. And who cares if they teach it or not?
Right.
You see? Now, there's a whole different feeling between those two points. And it's often the real teachers that are very reluctant to do the teaching.
I'd like to ask some more on this subject.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, and of course, I've having been a teacher, and I still teach, not spiritually, at least not in a formal sense, have come to realize that it's one thing to want to appear wise and want to have people look up to you, which is all purely egotistical. But there's another consideration here. What happens when you get someone to actually follow your advice? And what if your advice isn't all that good? Now what kind of situation are you in?
Well, you have to pay for it. You see, the whole problem with being a spiritual teacher, let's stay to the realm of the spiritual teachings, because
Right. The
other kind of teaching is just another way to get through your life, to get your experience. But let's speak of spiritual teachers. If you put yourself up as a spiritual teacher, or even if you don't give voice to that, you just say, well, we're just all meeting to discuss, but yet you find that you are the one who is ending up doing the actual most of the talking.
Mm-hmm.
In actuality, you are the teacher, and people look to you for this type of advice. Now then, let us say that you are not clear enough to have a large enough scope to your vision to realize that many people are on different levels and they need different things. And you will perhaps, when one of your students asks you if one type of thing is the right thing, you will spontaneously respond that no, you don't, well, it's all right, but actually it's not quite the best. Mm-hmm. And what you're really saying is that you are not able to understand where that person is and to speak to them from their point of spiritual development. You are placing on them your so-called higher view
mm-hmm.
of the thing and forcing them into something that they can't do
mm-hmm.
because they're not ready for it and they don't understand it. And that is one of the greatest problems on the earth plane as far as spiritual teachers are concerned. They are limited. I mean, they may profess to be universal and vast and so forth and to accept all things. But actually, most people on the earth plane have limits, and they should be aware of those limits. And they should realize that they have a belief limit, that there are certain things that they believe and certain things that they don't. And some of their students are going to be struggling toward the light and may feel drawn to a certain type of work, a certain type of spiritual work. And as a teacher, you have to be aware. You have to be able to know whether they are moving toward a real awareness, something that really is theirs, that is a part of their being, and encourage them and nurture that growth. You see, that's one kind of response. And the other response is to intellectually have made up your mind that that's a lesser path and say, oh, well, it's a lesser path.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
It's extremely precarious work. And I think that most spiritual teachers should be very leery of putting themselves up as anything more than just, what can I say? I think most so-called spiritual teachers would be wise to view themselves as people who probably enjoy what they're doing and are getting a lot out of it from an egotistical point of view, as well as maybe doing some good.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a much safer approach, because too many of them get into the area where they really feel that they are channels of the divine power, and most times it's just simply their own opinions, their own belief structure. You know, you can't teach past what you know. You can't. And I don't mean just know intellectually. Lots of people are saying things intellectually, but I mean, you cannot go past what you've experienced, because your words will not carry any power, and therefore nobody will change one iota. If you're running a group and there are no changes in that group, or just say some changes at the beginning and then everything levels off and everything is getting a little tedious and a little boring, realize that you've come to the end of your power and you've taught all you can, and they really are bored because they're not moving. You cannot provide any impetus, and they should leave and find a higher teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So, I hope that makes that clear.
Can I shift gears a little bit here?
Certainly.
And ask you something that's been on my mind for weeks and weeks, and my wife mentioned it again this evening from the St. Moses work. I have felt that there is a dangerous parallel between the Pharisees of the time of the New Testament and certain rigid fundamentalist Christians of today, in that the Pharisees, as far as I can see during the New Testament, who were also called lawyers, not that they understood the civil law, although they may have, but because they understood the Torah, the law from the Old Testament, the law from the Pentateuch. And they had that down pat. They memorized every single word. And when Christ came, he was giving a new teaching. He was saying, you were told this, and I tell you that. And he was healing people on the Sabbath and doing things that outraged them because of their, I would say, fundamentalist, rigid way of understanding what they had learned. Now, what I'm suggesting is that when the Christ force reincarnates today, it would not surprise me a bit if it were not the fundamentalists who were playing the role of the Pharisees and who were the first to condemn and crucify, if they could, the new teaching.
Well, it won't, yes, it will be them. It'll be a lot of others, too. It won't be just the so-called fundamentalists, although they will. There are an awful lot of very rigid people in many of the churches that are not in the fundamentalist movement, sir.
Mm-hmm.
You will find, for example, in the Roman Catholic faith, you will find the same thing. They have a great belief that their primary stumbling block from our perception is their one view that nothing will ever be added unto the teachings.
Right.
They claim that it has been revealed in Christ Jesus, and nothing further is to ever be revealed. And this, of course, will be extremely difficult, because when the new teaching comes, it will not be the old teaching. It will be a new teaching, and in fact, it's already happening. And they will respond in a very dogmatic way, and they will have the law on their side.
Mm-hmm.
So it will not only be the so-called born-agains and the fundamentalists, but it will also be very definite groups of any kind. And this will not only be in the Western world. This will be true. Many of the groups in Asia and in India have been around so long that they have pretty well... They figure they pretty well have it figured out,
mm-hmm.
and they have it written, and they have their Bibles, you know, the Vedas and the Upanishads and the sutras from, you know, it's all written, and although they may say, oh no, well we're ready for something new, it is really probably not the case. Many people will take on the role of the Pharisees, and be unwilling to take the new, because it means accepting the fact that they have to leave behind the old. And this is, of course, what's so frightening. When you think you have figured it all out,
mm-hmm.
when you think that you are on to it and really know what you're doing, and then somebody comes along and says, well, that was all right yesterday, but today's a whole new day,
mm-hmm.
you will be very resentful, you know. And this is why, not you, I mean the person involved in that kind of situation, will be extremely resentful.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we're looking for malleable minds. Malleable minds and hearts. Minds that are able to be courageous enough to question everything. To question everything. That's a very courageous mind. A mind that says, all right, today it's this way, but tomorrow it may be different. And I am going to be open to that. And to take new wine as it's poured into the world. And there are many in the world today like this, and many of them are clustered in the United States. Many of them are in the United States. This is why the beginning of the process will be here, and it will move on to other places, but the beginning will be here, because countries that are run by doctrines such as the Roman Catholic Church will have great trouble infiltrating in those areas. It will actually be easier in places like the Soviet Republic.
Indeed.
Yes, because it's much it's much easier to work on somebody who has no belief on something than it is to have to undo something.
Well, this is fascinating.
Because it's very difficult to undo something, you see. So there's not as much to bemoan in that area in the USSR as the world thinks today.
How about Red China?
Well, Red China is different because they have imposed, they're too new in their new game, you see. Games go in cycles, and their game that they're into now, their economic and their social movement here,
yes,
is very much a game. You know, well, it's everything on the earth plane is. We've gone into this before, but someday we should discuss if you would put that down in what sense I mean that. But this is almost through because she's getting very tired. Her throat is sore.
Very good.
But in any case, in China, you must realize that there are millions of people participating in this game. Millions. There's tremendous power in that.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
the more people are playing it, the more power is added to it. And it will have to go its own way around the wheel and drop off, you see. Mm-hmm. It will lose momentum eventually, but there is tremendous power, so it will be a long time before China moves out of that. Now, the USSR is different. They've been at it longer. Not only have they been at it longer, they've been at it long enough to know that a lot of it doesn't work. You know,
right,
there are cogs in this wheel. There are places in it that it doesn't work. There's the machinery breaks down, so to speak. Their game isn't running as smoothly.
And they're recognizing this.
They're recognizing it.
Even though they don't admit it to anybody.
Well, but they are inside. They know there's an, you know, they're just like everyone else. They have an outer and an inner aware. You know, what they say outside is not what they mean inside, oftentimes. And there is a disillusionment of the movement, and has been for a long time. And this will get greater and greater and greater. Now, of course, it will manifest in a polarity situation.
Within the country?
Within the country. Many people will become very, very avid believers in what is there now, in the party line, so to speak. And then there will be others who will break away and who will be just as avidly against it. So there will be this kind of a movement. But again, I say that it doesn't really matter. You see, what we're hoping for is a birth of new consciousness, new awareness, and we'll use any game in order to expedite it.
Is it best to stop now?
Did you have something on this particular thing?
Well, it just suggests to me that if we have a lot of the more malleable, courageous minds in this country, and then you mentioned the Soviet Union as also being in a position to receive the new teachings, I can only infer that perhaps the USSR and the USA will not be as far apart as they now appear.
Well, they're not as far apart as they now appear. You see, in their hearts, they're very similar peoples. They're both courageous. You know, the Soviet Union, the peoples of the Soviet Union are very courageous. They have great courage. As I think was, I mean, they may misuse it, you see, as in the wars, and mm-hmm. their defending of their land and so on. But that speaks to something. That speaks to a country that is not wasting away and is not weak and overrun with malaise. You mm-hmm. know, there is power there. Now, of course, it's going as they become more and more disillusioned, but then your country is becoming very disillusioned too.
Yeah.
So there is a movement, both of you, away from the governments that you're both espousing at this time. And from our perception, we see a great deal of similarity between the two countries and the peoples. And we see great potential for a bridge of beauty and light. There's no reason why the two countries need to keep this stance. And more, I think, people in both countries are becoming aware of that. As the exchanges keep up, things will happen. I think we'd best close now.
Yes,
and you'll be
good.
Sending this down?
Yes.
To our friends? Well, I would like to close with a farewell to them and my love to them. And I would be so happy to any questions you might have regarding what's going on in this tape and any impressions you have or feelings, if you'll just send them up. We'll be so glad to cover them for you. And as was discussed, if you have any private questions of your own that you would like answered that you think would be pertinent, please, please don't hesitate. Amen. Good night.
Good night, Bartholomew.